Welcome to Shortcut to Sunday. I'm Ben.
And I'm Bruce.
And this is your podcast for October 22nd, 2023, proper 29, the 21st Sunday after Pentecost in year A. And we're coming to you not live on behalf of Holy Family Episcopal Church in Fishers, Indiana. Bruce, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Good. I'm doing great, too. We had terrific donuts today after church.
Awesomeness.
We had a great... We played a Cahoots game, which was Episcopal 101 questions today.
Yeah, that was amazingly fun.
I was thoroughly embarrassed with my lack of knowledge, but it was a ton of fun.
Ton of fun.
So I'm going to keep
eating
my beautiful donut. Bruce, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on here at the church here coming up that we should make a note of?
Well, the big make a note of thing is Friday, October 27th is our trunk or treat in the parish hall. Mm-hmm. And we need more people to please sign up to host the table, which just means giving out candy. Some people like to decorate their table. Not required. The kids just want the candy. And we get...
True, though.
Oh, yeah.
Truly.
And I, of course, am trying to figure out how to make a Halloween train, since every decoration should include a train.
Yeah, some sort of spook or spectral train-based idea.
Yeah. Okay. Still thinking. And we entertain kids from the neighborhood as well as the parish during it. So it really is a super event.
I'm still chewing.
Yeah, by the way, I may have misheard you, but it sounded like you said proper 29, but it's proper 24.
Mm. So you are correct. Anyone, it says proper 24, and then it says in parentheses 29,
yeah.
But that's if we start the season as early as it possibly can.
Yeah.
And it's not that way this year.
Right. Roman Catholics tend to do that, but not Episcopalians.
Got it.
And how the lectionary is used.
There you go. You are correct. I do stand corrected, and happily so. So that's the big thing that's coming up. I feel like our broadcast next week will have a few more things to say, because we're starting to delve into, in the following week, the November things that occur early on. But
and
just to put them on.
Stay tuned for details on a chili cook-off.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I see you. I hear you. I'm looking forward to that.
It'll be fun.
Yeah. I will definitely participate in, both the cooking and the eating.
Yeah.
So
the details by next week.
Awesome. I don't want to do the broadcast anymore. Just, can we do the chili now?
You just want to do chili.
Can we do the chili now?
Not yet.
How about now?
No.
Okay.
Next week. We can have a cooking show.
Fine. Oh, that would be terribly boring for our listeners.
Oh, it would. Especially since my secret chili recipe, it consists of a lot of cans.
I mean, whose doesn't? But like,
no, yeah. Mine really does.
What kind of audio broadcast would it be if it was like, okay, so you want to get your onions so they look about like this? All right. Yeah, that's not helpful. Well, let's move to this day in church history. There's a rich number of things that occurred on October 22nd in our history books. So let's start all the way back at 362. The martyrdom of Theodoretus, a Greek-speaking Syrian Christian priest. Boy, that's a mouthful. During the reign of Emperor Julian the Apostate.
So who killed him? I wonder.
His relics will be taken to the, I've never been able to say this right. It's the mountain range. The Uzes? U-Z-E-S. Isn't that a mountain range? Am I off my rocker? In the south of France.
I'm not going to question your rocker, but I'm not sure where it's
at. It's a one-sided rocker.
Or what it is.
It's falling over. So it is... No, I'm wrong. It's a commune in Gard, in Gard, France.
So like a village. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Uses is the, okay. the way to say it, in the south of France. So his relics are taken to, there in the south of France and placed in the cathedral dedicated to him. But Theodoretus, Martyred
and
by
here, I thought that was a sore throat.
Yeah, if we record two of these back to back, I get a bad case of theateritis.
Yeah.
Yep. Then we don't have any entries for over 1,000 years, actually, which is interesting.
Yeah.
That it goes that far. 1660, King Charles II of England presents a proposed declaration of indulgence to independents and bishops. Oh, sorry. I should.
What?
Hold on one second here.
Yes.
Let me say it a little bit differently. A proposed, and then this is the title of the proposal, declaration of indulgence to independents. And so he presents that and to bishops who offer suggestions for revision. 3 days later, the revised declaration is issued. However, it never obtained the force of law because Parliament rejected it. So I'm really curious to know what the Declaration of Indulgence to Independence is. And secure Google search says... the suspension of the penal code against all religious nonconformists, Catholic and dissenters alike. So it's a declaration
that would
of
have been pretty radical.
Toleration is what another title for it.
Yeah.
Huh. And the bishops weren't wanted it to be revised, and then Parliament said no, thanks. So look at that. King Charles wanted King Charles II. Wanted to be a little nicer to people who were of different religious.
What year was that?
1660.
Okay.
So who?
Different king than I thought.
Who'd have thought? Who'd have thunk?
Yeah.
1708, we see the death in Leiden of Herman Witsius, a Dutch pastor and professor known for his evangelical zeal, faithful stewardship of churches, and elucidation. What does that word mean?
Talking well.
Oh.
That's why you didn't know it.
His elucidation of covenant theology.
What year?
1708.
Okay. I presume covenant theology refers to the group of Protestants known as covenant folks.
Is that a technical term?
Well, they so quickly split off into groups like pilgrims and stuff. Mm.
Covenantianarism. Yes,
well
indeed.
Well said.
Indeed.
Yeah. Totally made up, but well said.
I don't know how many Latin root endings I tried to throw on there in once, but I think it was at least two.
Why not?
1746, revival leader Jonathan Dickinson obtains a charter for the College of New Jersey to train Presbyterian pastors. It will become Princeton University.
I was going
to
guess Princeton.
Yep. 1844, between 50,000 and 100,000 followers of Baptist lay preacher William Miller. I don't know why that name seems hard.
Too easy.
It's the most vanilla name.
Yeah.
William Miller prepare for the quote Day of Atonement, the day Jesus will allegedly return.
And what day did he say it was?
1844. So we missed it. It's over, man.
Christians are so wacky.
Who am I to judge? Who am I? 1870, death in Jacksonville, Florida, of James William Charles Pennington. How many names can a gentleman have? An escaped slave who had become a Presbyterian pastor and abolitionist, author of the autobiographical The Fugitive Blacksmith, and of the first history of African Americans published in the United States. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
He does have a lot of names, though. I wonder... Weird slave name kind of a thing that happened of like, we're just gonna throw all sorts of saint names on it.
Yes, but also when someone was freed, they got to do name editing, and there was just like today it would be, well, you know, this people know me as this, so mm-hmm. I should keep some pieces of that. Mm. But I sure, no one who loved me had a choice on this, so I'm going to add some for them. Mm-hmm. And so that's sometimes why the names get really long.
JWCP. Which kind of rolls off the tongue a little bit.
Not bad, yeah.
1899, American Presbyterian missionary James B. Rogers baptizes the first Filipino Protestants to receive the rite. So, Protestantism.
Is it Protestantarianism? Is spelled R-I-T-E?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Which means some kind of liturgy.
Right. Right, right. So, American Presbyterian missionary travels to the Philippines. Yeah, Protestants there.
Well, it was, in terms of colonialism, it was originally a Roman Catholic country. So when it became a American property, there were Anglos just crawling over each other to become missionaries to this new American territory, mm-hmm. including the Episcopal Church.
Yeah. 1903, death of Susanna Spurgeon, wife of English Baptist preacher Charles Haddon Spurgeon. They'd been married for a total of 36 years until he had passed away 11 years earlier, and she had been a part of all of her husband's ministry. So, it doesn't say all of, most of his her husband's ministries that they served side by side on.
Nice.
1922, death of Lyman Abbott, Congregationalist pastor, publisher, and advocate of social justice. He had been editor-in-chief of the Christian Union, a widely read magazine that held liberal positions on most issues.
Oh, good.
There you go. 1939, C.S. Lewis preaches a sermon at the University Church of St. Mary the Virgin in Oxford, in which he asks, "How can we study Latin, geography, algebra in a time like this? Aren't we just fiddling while Rome burns?" He then assures the assembled students that it is worthwhile and essential to continue studies even in the face of World War II.
That was obviously a significant question at the time.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis had participated in World War I, so mm-hmm. if memory serves, and that was definitely a defining him and Tolkien. Those were defining moments for them for sure. A little bit older, and then the Second World War comes around, and
this wasn't supposed to happen.
They probably had a lot to say about it. Yeah. 1965, death of Paul Tillich, existentialist Lutheran theologian.
I don't know if he's really existentialist, but conservative Christians label him that way.
This comes from people.bu.edu. So, notorious among Orthodox believers for reducing the work of the historical Jesus Christ to complex abstractions, but that's abstractions? Is that a real different word, or is this a typo on the...
It's when a Scandinavian singing group...
There it is.
...does theology.
Abba. Abstractions. I got it. I get it.
There you go.
There it is.
Okay.
No, it is not a word. It is a misspelling. Okay. So, he reduced the work of historical Jesus Christ to complex abstractions and describing God as the, quote, ground of all being, end quote, among other non-traditional theological innovations. So, existentialist Lutheran theologian.
Not existentialist.
But not according to Bruce.
No. And he is buried in New Harmony, Indiana.
Oh.
And was a frequent guest there of a very prominent Episcopalian, and worshipped at the Episcopal Church there in New Harmony, St. Stephen's. And when he died, he left his library to that family. Mm-hmm. And so one of the guest houses in New Harmony has Paul Tillich's library, including the margin notes that he made, which is just amazing to look at.
And for your personal taste, there's not enough existentialist material in his library. And that's...
Oh, definitely not.
Okay.
He was a very middle of the road modernist.
For Lutheran?
Huh?
For Lutheran, though? I mean, does that make the difference?
No. He was thoroughly attacked by conservative Christians with within his lifetime and ever since. Mm. And he had some odd. Okay, one of the things that theologians often do is either make up words or combine words in a way that no one has done before in order to be able to set precise definitions for the development of whatever point they're going to make.
Mm, okay.
And so he had a book of theology that was three volumes long.
Mm-hmm.
And so he certainly was going to create some words.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was really criticized for not using just, well, this has been good enough for 1,000 years. Why is he making up this stuff? And I thought, come on. So yeah, I think he was the one who used the term ultimate concern.
Oh, okay.
Referring to humanity's seeking God.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been McCrory, but anyway, I liked reading his stuff. And, you know, like with any theologian, he's a human. So you don't take it all as gospel.
Right.
And you certainly don't throw out baby with bathwater if you didn't like some of his terminology.
Right. No, that makes sense. 1969, Harold John Okenga, a leading fundamentalist. Any argument there? No, I'm just kidding. Is inaugurated.
I have to figure out who he is first.
Is inaugurated as president of Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. Ooh, from the Biographical Dictionary of Evangelicals.
Okay, so I don't know.
Yeah, no. And lastly,
some I do.
Lastly, 1987, a volume of Gutenberg's original Bible is sold at auction at Christie's for $5.39 million, one of the largest sums ever paid for a printed book. Ironically, I love that they do this for this entry. Ironically, Gutenberg had not profited from his invention of printing because his press was seized for debts.
I'd forgotten that. I did know that, but I'd forgotten that.
So, with that, I think that is the end.
Aren't humans wonderful?
Yeah, right? Who'd have thunk? You know, I mean, if you think about it realistically, you know, Joe Blow has borrows money to create some wacky invention, can't pay it, you know, pay the debt on it, and you go and seize this weird contraption. All that makes some sense. That's not out of, you know, I mean, those debtors didn't have the foresight to know, like, oh, this is going to revolutionize.
I think they did.
You think so?
Yeah, because, okay. I mean, it wasn't like, whoa, why didn't we think of that? There were lots of people trying to engineer a printing press. It was clear that there was a need.
Gotcha.
And Gutenberg was the first one to cross the finish line, and it's like, good work. Give it. It's ours now.
Congratulations. You're 3 months past due, and it's mine now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Rather than waiting, you know,
Yeah, I don't know why I wanted to give humanity
That's so unlikely.
I know, right? It really is. I don't know why that was my instinct. Of course it was a terrible thought.
Underhanded,
exactly. That's this day in church history, or Christian history, I suppose, is a little bit more of a...
It's more church.
It is, I mean, more church.
Because it is more... Most of these entries that we get through the weeks are more institutional churches.
Yes. Churches, missionary work. And, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the road to Damascus occurred. Yeah, no, exactly. Let's go to our first reading.
Yes.
This one comes to us from Isaiah chapter 45, verse 1 through 7. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have grasped to subdue nations before him and strip kings of their robes, to open doors before him, and the gates shall not be closed. I will go before you and level the mountains. I will break in pieces the doors of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness and riches hidden in secret places so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by your name. For the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel, my chosen, I call you by your name. I surname you, though you do not know me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I arm you, though you do not know me, so that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is no one besides me. I am the Lord, and there is no other. I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I, the Lord, do all these things. Cyrus, who's this guy? Do we know anything outside of the writings of Isaiah about
him? Yes.
Okay.
Because he was a Babylonian king.
Okay, okay.
So Babylonians had a very prolific writing tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of secondary sources outside of the scripture on, yeah, who was Cyrus? And what's happening in these verses, to anticipate your next question,
yes,
is Babylonian religion being transformed by God for God's uses.
Mm.
So there's a Babylonian tradition that the king had to be renewed by the Babylonian gods each year to rule.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't an automatic lifetime appointment. And here God takes the role.
Mm.
Of the Babylonian kings, in other words, or gods, in other words, says, yeah, no, those guys don't exist, but right. I will use you for my purposes.
Hmm. So, I mean, in a very interesting way, because this is a second Isaiah?
I think so.
Okay. So in a way, this is like a, he's running for re-election.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Jewish state gives their letter of recommendation or a letter of approval, like
that's part of the scandal here. After all, they're enslaved,
right? Exactly. But it does go beyond that, of course, and does have this. So, which is interesting, because usually when you think about how these old prophet books are written, it's usually about either A, foreign king, I will come down upon, the Lord's vengeance will come down upon mm-hmm. you swiftly and angrily, or whatever.
Swords, fire,
etc. Yeah. Or anointing a king of Israel. And being like, this is who's mm-hmm. going to lead us.
Right.
So
from the Davidic line.
Right. So this is definitely it's not fully uncommon in its nature, but I don't know as if I remember there being anything about this like a king before. And I think, there've been a couple of higher up positioned individuals throughout the Old Testament that had a kind of a blessing from the Jewish God, of a story, but I can't recall another time that it was a king.
Right. You're right on that. Cause they're like, Joseph in context of Egypt. I mean,
sure.
That mm-hmm. Joseph, not mm-hmm. Jesus's stepfather. There's a long list of non-royalty that are used by God.
Mm-hmm.
Cyrus, only king, and in the last presidential election, the passages about Cyrus was the justification that conservative Christians gave voting for Trump,
mm-hmm.
who theologically they were in disagreement with.
I was trying to remember if that was one and the same, if it was the stories of Cyrus.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha.
Inappropriate use of scripture. I'll just say that and mean it. But that frankly, that also tells me there are no other kings because they that God used.
Yeah, I have to admit, not to get political. We'll shift away from it after this. But I have to say, no matter who it is, if it's like, oh, this is God's chosen candidate, like, I've read enough of this to know that that's not exactly how this works.
That's right. And things really don't work out well for the Babylonians by the end of Isaiah.
Yeah.
I mean, they are conquered and turned to dust, and their buildings are shoved down.
Yeah. Yep. Well, shoot. Yeah. I mean, there's very few entries where it's like God has a writing like this, even for Israel's kings.
Yeah.
Where it's like they don't end up disappointing in the end.
Yeah, I mean, that because
definitely God's favor shines upon you, and you messed it up.
Yeah.
Well, shoot. Maybe this guy over here, and he's gone. Okay. Well, all right.
To put it in terms that everyone can understand, I'll wait till you drink.
Mm-hmm.
The Raiders, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they're looking for the chalice from the Last Supper.
Oh, that's okay. You're mixing. It's Indiana Jones, but you're mixing
Indiana Jones.
Yes.
And the Last Crusade.
The Last Crusade. So not Raiders.
And
third one.
You get to watch people's faces melt, and the old knight say, "He chose poorly." That's what happens. To people like Cyrus,
right?
And as you said, many Jewish kings as well, where it's like, hey. Obviously, this is grand and royal, so that's what I should do. He chose poorly.
Yeah. You know what? Actually, that's not a bad analogy of, like, the being chosen by God is more the opportunity to even enter that room.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's you. It's not like, and then God said, hey, it's the cup of the that looks like the cup of a carpenter.
Yeah.
It's that one over there. Go drink from that one.
Just my little... Two comments, mm-hmm. Nothing to do with this. I'm not sure why that cup did not look more wooden.
So, yeah, it looked very gold wooden.
Yeah. They did certainly have wooden chalices at that time.
Sure.
If that was the standard. And in one of the melty bad choices, mm-hmm. there was a screw and nut visible underneath. That
yes,
and I could identify which church catalog they got it from.
Full detour.
Yeah, props should have covered that up with some
probably
flannel or something.
Yeah, it made it look like some sort of melted welding piece or something,
or just a cloth bottom.
Yeah, full detour. There's also plates, like in the background as well.
On the shelf, sort of.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, I don't know. I mean,
I get the full set?
I enjoy the humanity of Christ the Savior and like the concepts around that, but I can't envision my Lord and Savior drinking from a plate. I just can't. I can't. That is too human of a thing of like, well, the rest were dirty, so
he was a bachelor.
Right? Guess I'll eat my Cheerios and milk on a slightly beveled plate.
Yeah, and meanwhile the apostles are, he must be the Messiah. He didn't spill a drop.
Right.
There are no lucky charms on the floor.
jerking the wheel of the bus all the way to the left. This is kind of not only is it God saying about Cyrus of like, hey, even though you don't know me, I'm choosing you, but there's also this and you're gonna be successful. You're gonna whose right hand I have grasped to subdue nations before him and strip kings of their robes. I suppose actually that's not so much this is what you're going to do. This is God saying, all that success you've had, that was me.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will go before you and level the mountains. I will break in pieces the doors of bronze and cut through the bars of iron. It really does sound like God saying, like, I know you're going to keep pillaging.
Right.
Taking over the land.
That was my temple, you sacked.
Yes. So in a way, it's a little odd. I'm like, yeah, let's continue the, you know, the continental barrage and just.
Well, the next verse, I will give you the treasures of darkness and riches hidden in secret places, so that you may know that it is I, the Lord, the God of Israel, who call you by name. Mm. So part of this is you can't hide from me. I am the one God of the earth. Mm. And so, yeah, I know where you've been stealing stuff from.
Even
though it's not from the country that worships me, mm-hmm. I've seen it all.
Mm, gotcha.
Nothing's a secret from me. And like you said, what you have gotten, I let you get.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the use of the word surname in verse 4. It's like the way that it's phrased there.
Yeah.
I call you by your name. I surname you, though you do not know me. Which is an interesting thing, right? Like, so I'm trying to think of like how that actually works. 'Cause the surname is like a combination of like your given name and your family name. Right. So like it's
usually,
so I'm not sure like exactly my brain doesn't quite know what to make of.
Yeah.
That phrase.
What the heck is it saying?
Yeah, exactly. Again, potentially a very British. Because you don't see that in the Bible, right? Like, you don't see, like, oh, this is... This is...
Christ is not Jesus' last name.
This is Isaac Johnson.
Right.
And son of Abraham Johnson. Like, it's just, like, not a thing.
Well, the closest we get, I'm thinking in the Gospels, is... John, the son of Zebedee.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Because son of Zebedee would have the same use as a last name does
in
American culture.
Yeah, and we do see that in the genealogies in the Old Testament. Like, this person, son of Saroto, son of so-and-so, who lived 700 years. And this person, so, you know. So we still, it's not fully an uncommon use to have a surname adjacent reference, but
I'm looking at the Hebrew,
yeah,
and I can't figure out what word the New Revised chose to translate as surname. Let's see, what does that say?
Deep in translative thoughts,
with a
Bruce furrowed, goes through his laptop
with a furrowed brow.
Oh, what?
Furrowed brow.
I thought, I don't know why I was making the joke, you and you played into actually, it, and I thought you were like reading like actually, it's a furrowed brow in the translation. I'm dumb.
I didn't hold up my little sign that says just kidding.
Just kidding. Joke now.
You know, I don't want to say something that leads anyone astray. So I'm just going to say I can't figure out.
You can't seem to find where that came from.
Yeah, there are possibilities of. What's that one? There are various words for name,
mm-hmm.
you, two different words for name use. I presume it's one of those, but when I'm looking at the dictionary, the Hebrew dictionary, it's like, no.
Yeah, so the way it's phrased in the translation seems, if there's not a direct translation option here, then it seems as though the translator is making the decision almost to say that God is saying, you're part of the family now.
Yes, that is definitely the intent.
Which is interesting because that's a very different There's a different vibe between, hey, I've chosen you, and hey, you're now part of the family.
Yes.
Because as we've talked about before on the podcast, no, like being naming someone, especially from a deity standpoint, is
powerful.
A source of control.
Yeah.
Right. So I call you by your name means you're gonna do what I tell you to do, which is a different vibe than, and we're family. Like, you know, you're now part of the tribe and join us and, you know, see us. I can't wait to see you on feast days. Like it's,
yeah,
that's not quite the vibe. The vibe is, I feel like at least through this is, I'm establishing control here where you didn't know it existed. You thought resided with yourself, with your gods, and I'm here to tell you, you're not in control.
Yeah.
That's different.
And he's literally enslaved the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
So lowest of the low within his society. And near as I can tell, the surname thing is actually grafting him into the house of Jacob.
Mm.
So it's like, okay, I'm the one true God. You're one of mine. It's like, good. You know, and what's that called? And then use the term for the house of Jacob. Wait a minute, those are the guys that wash my feet.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. I don't know if I want this deal.
All right, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So,
So a little bit of translative choice here that we're seeing.
And again, the New Revised Standard, like the Revised Standard before, it tries to do a word for word translation. So if it uses one word in Hebrew, they'll try to use one word in English. So they couldn't say, grafted you into the house of Jacob. Instead, I gave you a surname.
Gotcha. Okay. Anything else about this entry?
It's technically a call story.
Mm.
So, you know, the way Paul was called after the resurrection of Jesus calling his apostles, the various prophets being called, and it's very radical that a foreign tyrant is being called by God to cooperate with God's desires.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So it's in no way is it a compliment to Cyrus.
Gotcha.
But it does show how God's willing to work whatever is available.
Mm.
And since the Israelites were being so bad at following God, God's gone to another plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is plan D, E, or F probably.
Right.
Like, okay, who we got left? Gabriel? Cyrus? Yeah, let's give it a shot.
Right. Little known fact, Cyrus is the great, 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 great granddad of Billy Ray. Moving on. I was waiting to do that one.
Yeah. 3 years from now, may you enjoy it just as much.
Psalm 96, verses 1 through 13. 10 through 13 is an optional, but you know what? I like the Psalms. So
they're our friend.
They are, Psalms are our friend. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be revered above all gods, for all the gods of the peoples are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in holy splendor. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord is king. The world is firmly established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar, and all that fills it. Let the field exult, and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord. For he is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness, and the peoples with his truth. This is a hymn.
Definitely.
Mostly because I've sung it. At least the first part.
It's still a hymn.
Yes.
It was written to be a hymn.
But what else do we know about Psalm 96 here?
It's certainly from the temple era.
Mm-hmm.
And probably was enthronement psalm for for a human king.
Mm-hmm.
because it puts things in perspective for that human that you may be, we're having this grand service, mm-hmm. to bless you as king, but you're still God's servant just like any of us.
Right. The Lord is king.
Yeah.
What does it mean by the world is firmly established? What an interesting phrase.
The world's made.
It shall never be moved.
Yeah, it's... this is in the Book of Common Prayer as one of the canticles that can be said or sung at morning prayer.
Okay.
So it's one of these that's been a part of my life on an almost daily basis for over 40 years now. So one of the things I have to constantly do is set aside 40 years of experience with it and look at it freshly. So that's why I kind of went,
sure. No, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it.
One of the strongest themes within scripture is chaos versus blessing. So this is one of those times when God's explicitly, well, subtly, but clearly on the side of not chaos.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the earth is firmly here. And God did it.
Right.
God brought out of the chaos God created.
Yeah, I have to admit, as I'm reading it, I'm sitting here thinking, from a human perspective, I think our first instinct is to think about how old this psalm is, when it was written.
Yeah.
And you almost sit there and go, oh, that's not right at all. You know what I mean? Like there have been titanic shifts here in the world. So much has changed. And yet you sit here and if you think of, or at least for me, I sit and ponder it a little further. It's a different level of the same thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? The world hasn't changed. It's still the same.
Yeah.
There are, the players, the actors in are different,
mm-hmm.
but the play is the same. And we're
different people speak the same lines.
Right. And we're still terrible people, mm-hmm. and we still need constant reminders. So it is I did the full, double 180 on this of like, no, that's not right. Well, yeah, maybe it is.
And one thing to build on what you're saying is the very last verse. For he is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and peoples with his truth.
Mm-hmm.
For modern Western ears, that's like, oh, there's that judgment stuff again.
Mm-hmm.
But for the people for whom this was written, it's amazing that there's a judge who is not corrupt.
Right, right.
And it's a hope, mm-hmm. that there finally will be a non-corrupt judge.
Right.
And God personifies that.
Yeah, it has the word judge in there, which we think as like, the separating the, you know, the chaff from the
let there be gnashing of teeth.
Yes, exactly. And it really is like, no, he's going to judge the world with righteousness, which is something no one does.
Yeah.
Literally no one, none of us do. And the peoples with his truth. So it's especially for a people who have been judged time and time and time again, as with all peoples from history past, somebody ended up judging them.
Yes.
And it's not this way.
Right. Right.
Oh, you're that kind of person. Death. enslavement. Poverty.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's how we judge.
And in the Hebrew word could be translated as vindicate.
Hmm. Okay.
With connotation of it's a vindication coming out of making things right.
Right.
And having God's ways be the ways of existence, which the psalmist presuming it's not happening, and that's why we have to remind everyone of who God is.
Right.
Especially if you're getting a new earthly king.
Right. Exactly. Anything else about the psalm?
Boy, it's a good one. I better just move on in terms of time.
Sounds good. Our gospel reading this week comes from the book of Matthew, as it has been. Chapter 22, verses 15 through 22.
As it has been.
Then the Pharisees went and plotted to entrap him in what he said. So they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with truth, and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. Then he said to them, "Whose head is this, and whose title?" They answered, "The emperor's." Then he said to them, "Give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. One of the more infamous run-ins with the Pharisees. We are through, if I'm not mistaken, all of the other word traps that they've set before him, and I think we're at the end of the parables. There's like a series of like seven of them with the Pharisees. This is like a whole bunch of back and forth.
No.
Are we not done? Do we keep going?
Well, we don't necessarily keep going with parables.
Okay.
But we keep going with the sort of poker game of what will you say to this Jesus?
Right. What about working on the Sabbath? Okay. All right. Well, we won't spoil next week.
But you better be in church.
We'll work on the Sabbath later. So this is that famous line. Render to Caesar what that is Caesar's, and render to God what is God's. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know as if I necessarily put two and two together. This is as far as entrapments go. I'm wondering how clever this actually is by the Pharisees, or how obvious it was, because I didn't realize that, at least in the book of Matthew, it says that they come to him, they send their disciples along with followers of Herod, Herodians, which I don't know as if I picked up on, in readings past. And, so part of me wonders if Jesus goes, okay, I see what you're doing here. Well, I know that guy.
Yeah.
Gee, why is that guy? So you want me to, like, this is like basic, like, so you want to get me to say this exact thing, and it's pretty obvious. You know, you don't have your tape recorders to catch me, but you do have your Herodian followers here to hear it.
And in Mark, it also explicitly says there.
Does it say the Herodians? Interesting. Yeah.
Luke does not.
I don't know as if I ever caught on to that.
Yeah.
Hmm. But I love this this false praise that comes out at the beginning of the question. Oh, you know, it's like, oh, mighty teacher, you are so good. And because you're so good, I haven't got a question for you. It's a little tiny question. Not that big of a deal.
Yeah, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have that compliment.
This thing. What a snake.
Right.
Teacher, we know that you are sincere. Aww. Teach the way and teach the way of God in accordance with truth, and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality. I'm trying to think of like what all is in this buttering up the like, because it's obviously this is the setting of the stage, right? It is they're elevate intentionally verbally elevating him to a higher position, like a position of note, of certain quality, because if you don't, then when you stumble, there's nowhere to fall. So you gotta like, oh, you're so smart.
Right.
So sincere. But like in a way, some of this phrasing in my head shows how dumb they are, because the Pharisees and Jesus aren't that far off.
Right.
You know, I mean, like if you've ever read these Bible stories and thought that the group of Pharisees were some sort of crazy, heretical, like offshoot from the woods that has nothing to do with the Jewish community at all. No. I mean, these are people in positions of power, and Jesus constantly challenges that. Yeah, it's kind of his base nature, but they're shades of the same color.
Yeah, they're to use modern terminology, they both are on the liberal end of Judaism.
Yeah. So in this buttering up section, that they say, you teach the way of God in accordance with truth, which really does verbally create a strong connection between Jesus and the Pharisees right here in this moment. So if Jesus fails this and the Herodians hear it, I don't know as if they're going to necessarily go like, oh, okay, Pharisees, you're cool. This guy's not cool, but you're cool. Like, you just linked yourselves, like, explicitly. And so if this guy says something that you don't like, he represents all of us here in this moment.
They see what you're saying.
They kind of mess up in that regard.
Well, and that's part of scripture, where people think they're saying something that hides who they really are, when in fact they're saying they're making more clear who they really are.
Yeah.
Because they have no self-awareness.
Yeah. So if the Pharisees succeed, the end result actually becomes, okay, shut it all down. All of it. Shut it all down. You go to the stockades. You go to the stockades. Everybody goes to jail. We're shutting it down. Mm-hmm. So not smart. Not smart. Not great.
And okay, this again takes place during what we now call Holy Week.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone who is scared of Jesus, everyone in authority who is scared of Jesus, is trying to figure out how to corral him, how to get him under control, get him to behave.
Mm-hmm.
So the Pharisees are not necessarily trying to say, yeah, we're the same.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they're trying to put the brakes on him.
Right.
By making the Herodians do it. And Jesus wiggles out of the trap very easily.
Right.
Because the Pharisees are so unself-aware that, first of all, you don't realize just everything you said about running the stockade, but also it very well may be that these are the words that the Holy Spirit gave them. And say, yeah, you know, we're working on God's side, so this is what we say.
Right.
Yeah, the coming like 25 years later.
Right. Or there's a version of this that's a little bit more Hugh Grantish in its like babbling. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, not that you're sincere. Not that you're not sincere. But
yes.
A little bit of that. Teach the way in Gordon's God's truth. Well, your truth of God's truth, not our truth. Not the point of truth being yours with God, but not necessarily ours. And
though there is only one God.
There's only one God. But of course, except for, you know, God of, you know, Rome, Caesar, and all the so
good barbecues.
But not barbecues.
The sacrifice is delicious. We all agree,
right? In my mind, that's what
actually that's pretty good.
And Matthew goes, shrink. It was rough. But Jesus here kind of puts the kibosh on it even before the answer by calling them hypocrites.
Well, yeah.
So in a way, he kind of like helps him out there just in case he answers it wrong. I'm like, you're a bunch of hypocrites. You and I aren't the same. Break that tie right there. And then I what I love is that he uses them to answer the question.
Yeah.
Which is like a kind of a fun thing. A thing too that sometimes you like do with like a kid. You know what I mean?
Yes.
All right. Well, bring me the homework. What does it say? No, that's not what it says. What does it actually say? Yeah. No, this word here, you're skipping. You're not catching the full question. You're not thinking of it right. You know, that kind of a thing. It's great it does. It feels. I wonder if that's the reason why it works so well as like a kid's Bible story.
Oh, yeah.
Like, because. He really treats them like children.
Yeah.
Well, bring me a denarius. What is it? Go ahead. All right. Whose face? That's not. No. Jesus is not the answer, kids. That's not. No. No. Yes. Yes.
You want to
the emperor. That's right. The emperor. But I thought the answer to all our questions in Bible school is Jesus.
There you go.
Thank you. But yeah, it's so funny to me as I start to like think about it and dig into it a little bit.
Incidentally,
mm-hmm.
We aren't quite sure who the Herodians were.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
we're just as kind of a. It wasn't necessarily like, oh, yes, that was a faction of blah blah blah.
Right.
It might just be a title of like those loyal to Herod.
Right.
Gotcha.
Right. In other words, in history, there isn't. History being independent sources,
mm-hmm.
History books and such from the Romans. There's nothing that describes the Herodians. Thank you.
Yep.
But I think it's
during the fall of Rome, the Herodians headed east.
Right.
Yeah. No. Okay. I got you.
So there's a presumption because there's an interest in money mm-hmm. that so Christians have interpreted this that because this is about money, the Herodians must be people who benefit from Herod being the figurehead king that the Romans
invited. Right. These are the snitches. That's who they are.
Well, bootlickers.
Yeah. Well, for the purposes of the Pharisees, this is who's going to, like...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you what he's saying. I just want you to hear it for yourself.
That's right.
And whatever you do with that is your...
Your own
your
business.
Prerogative.
Yeah. You're an adult.
And I love that the end of this story is essentially the Herodians go back and are like, those Pharisees are a bunch of morons. I wasted so much time going down to the temple and just to watch them like fumble over their question and then get treated like children.
And as we left, we saw a bunch of Sadducees coming out. But we couldn't watch anywhere. It's just, I felt for them.
That was ugly. That was painful. I just couldn't take anymore. But yeah, and really what I, the most famous part of the story, this line, give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's, it's a great tagline for really a lot of Jesus's ministry, because I feel like we talk about it all the time. His ministry is one of, in a way, it's subversive. It's one of subversion. You have this expectation, or you elevate certain things to a position of power and importance, and constantly in Jesus' ministry is like, that's not important. That's not the mm-hmm. thing. Oh, but this thing in the temple with like the structure, and that's not the point.
Regardless of what you'd like for yourself.
Exactly. And so like constantly, we're looking for a new king. Who cares? Who cares? That's not what I'm here for. And he's constantly trying to draw focus of giving back to God the things that are important, which is love and generosity and time and devotion. And, those are the things that matter. And we're constantly going to the tactile and what we can touch, what we can possess, what we can hold. And it's just, in a way, it's a great tagline for his ministry, I think, and because it sums a lot of it up. You can insert anything into that first part of the sentence, and it works.
Yeah, and part of the punchline also is everything belongs to God,
right?
So, there's nothing we get to hold back and say, yeah, God gets this. This stuff, the video games, those are mine.
Right.
Clearly, God doesn't want video games.
Right. Well, even like institutional things.
Yeah.
Like, because I mean, we'll hear Easter's. When Easter rolls around, we have the story about the other folks who are on the cross, and mm-hmm. You could reuse this phrase at that point in time. Oh, we have this whole conversation. That other guy on the cross was never baptized.
Right.
Give to baptism what is baptism's, and give to God things that are God's. Even those institutional markers of like.
Then I'm picturing someone saying, "Even here, Jesus, we don't have a lot of time. Make it clear.
Stop with the taglines. I know we didn't have time to get T-shirts made, but stop it.
No more riddles.
You're on the cross. Give it up.
Yeah, and okay. Interesting thing here.
Mm-hmm.
Hypocrite. Jesus uses hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
In until this, I'm pointing at a Bible.
Okay. Yeah.
In Greek, hypocrites meant actors.
Oh.
And it collected the negative connotation through Christianity.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I do play a little bit of a hypocrite on this podcast.
Yes, you do.
Both versions. Duly hypocritical.
So in some ways, it was totally backing up what you're saying, that this is like a child-adult conversation,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, you guys are just playing here.
Yeah.
Is what he's saying, rather than having such an evil connotation that it has now in English.
Gotcha. Why this false tone?
Yeah.
Okay, so that really then does one more change to the entry question. Teacher, we know that you are sincere and teach the way of God in accordance with truth. Hark, and show deference to no one.
Lower arm.
Lower arm.
Oh, wait. No, I don't really
point and ask questions sternly.
Yeah, that's that. I think we lose something by not going with. I don't know how you would do it in one word. And certainly since the King James the hypocrite term has been used in that location. Mm. But I just think it's a lot more fun to think of this as a badly done play acting.
Well, and it does. It points to the earlier part of that same sentence. Jesus, aware of their malice.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah,
Why are you playing? You don't talk like that normally. You know.
Well,
who put you up to this? Who wrote your script? Who did it? It was pretty good, but
I know she does not listen to the podcast. Her mom does, but I'll say Frankie has started to do this thing. Frankie's 7 years old. That she thinks she's being really clever in, like, well, what do you want for dinner? Or what do you want to play? Mm-hmm. It's like, this is your time, child.
Mm-hmm.
And you think you're going to trick me into saying what you want.
Right, right. It's a great precursor. What do you want, Frankie?
Exactly. And that's how I respond. He's like, ugh.
What's your real question?
What I usually do is say, oh, I'd love to have snails for dinner.
Nice. Yes, my wife and I always, the phrase we always use was, what's your real question?
Yeah, that'd be more polite if I did that.
It's not that polite when we do it. What's your real question? We are direct people. What do you want? What's the ask? Let's get it done. So, sternly. You hypocrite.
Two-letter email.
I'm going to start.
Two-sentence email. That's it.
I'm going to – my big takeaway for this week, and yours, those listening should be too. I'm going to start that when I recognize that style of question. I'm just going to go, you hypocrite. What's your real question? Get to it. Get to the point. And with that – I think we call to a close this your podcast for October 22nd, 2023, the 21st Sunday after Pentecost in year A. As always, we encourage you to join us in worship however it works for you, for your family, for your time frame, 8 and 10 o'clock in person here in Fishers, and with the 9 o'clock educational hour for all ages in between. Full blast. And the 10 o'clock service will be broadcast on our YouTube channel, HFEC Videos. And until next week, I'm Ben.
And a big hello to all people on fall break.
Yes. We miss you. Come back.
I was going to say drive safely as you
listen to this. Oh, that too. So that you can come back. And until next week, I'm Ben.
I'm Bruce.
And we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.